Broadcasting.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue to order. Apologies for starting late. We had a late floor session. So we're going to so people who are listening can be aware, we are going to put over House Bill 2693. And we also lack the paperwork on Senate Bill 464, so that may or may not be taken up this session. We'll save that to the end. And we will have public hearings on House Bill 2008 and Senate Bill 139, and we will do a work session on Senate Bill 806. So we will start with a public hearing on House Bill 2008.
Or a roll call.
I'm sorry, we will start with a roll call. I'm trying to save time here.
Senator Finley.
Excused.
Senator Riley.
Present by video.
Senator Wagner.
Wagner's present by video.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Excused. Madam Chair. He's here. He's here. Oh, no, he's not. Boquist is excused.
Madam Chair Burdick.
Present by video. Okay, we will start now. We will start off with a public hearing on House Bill 2008.
Chair Burdick, members of committee, this is Jane McGovern for Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 2008 allows a tax exemption for property that's owned by houses of worship, but would now be used for low-income housing, and those low-income housing properties or portions of the property would have to be under a 60-year minimum low-income affordability covenant. And I can also be available to answer questions, but I think we have the speaker here to speak about the bill.
We do indeed have the speaker. Welcome, Speaker Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, everyone. For the record, I am Tina Kotek. I'm the state representative for House District 44, which is north and northeast Portland, excuse me, and the Speaker of the Oregon House. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today to introduce House Bill 2008B. The bill, after it was introduced, was amended once in the House Committee on Housing, as well as the House Committee on Revenue. And I'm very pleased to have this bill before your committee today. So thank you for taking the time. The bill passed our floor with a 54-member vote. Has strong bipartisan co-sponsors. It's pretty simple. The goal here is to allow religious organizations who have property, who are currently, that property is tax exempt, to be allowed to develop it for affordable housing. I have a church in my district who wanted to be part of solving the housing crisis in Portland, and it took them 5 years to get through the regulatory scheme in Portland to finally be where they are now, which is they're in construction. And they want to build very low-income housing to serve their community, to keep people in the community. And I think that's something we should encourage. So the bill streamlines the process by which these religious organizations could build affordable housing. It has criteria there. Basically says cities have to approve it as long as they meet certain criteria and kind of move them through the process quicker. So that is a plus. And in doing the original bill, which was mostly about the land use process, we discovered that there was a court ruling that was telling churches that if you converted your already tax-exempt property to affordable housing, as opposed to a shelter, but affordable housing, you would then have to pay taxes on that property. So we added a portion about property taxes, and that's why it's in front of your committee. It's pretty straightforward. It basically says that the tax-exempt status they currently have would remain because it's used for religious purposes. They could build affordable housing. We've tried to keep the reporting relatively simple. I know Department of Revenue still has some concerns. There was a lot of discussion about all the assorted tax preferences and credits we have for affordable housing and how we keep track of that. This bill is not meant to solve that, but what we are asking them to do is on the initial application, that initial application based on this exemption would go to Department of Revenue. We're not asking them to do anything with it, but it seems like the first step for them to at least have the information And we probably need to have a broader conversation about how we would keep track and hold accountable the folks who are using various tax breaks for affordable housing. But remember, these are properties that are already tax exempt. And if people commit to the criteria in the bill for affordable housing, we would like them continue to have that tax exempt status so they can provide the housing and very low income residents in their community could use. So with that, I'll stop and appreciate your time and thank you for the opportunity today.
And thank you for bringing us this bill. Question, Senator Riley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Speaker Kotek, thank you very much for bringing this bill to us. I think this is something that will work well, and I hope we will be able to get it through. I just wanted to ask you one simple question. Does a property that is used for building have to be on the same physical property as the place of worship?
Madam Chair and Senator Riley, thank you for the question. No, not technically. However, yes, I suppose there would be an opportunity for a religious organization owns a piece of property that is part of their mission somewhere not contiguous to their, you know, place of worship. I think that would be pretty unlikely. In my district, I'm really thinking about those kind of old mainline churches who are sitting on very large plots of land. You have a church, a giant parking lot, a big side lot, all of it is all in one spot. That would be where they would be doing the development. That's the case of the church in my district, Portsmouth Union. But technically, I suppose it is possible that it wouldn't be there. I'm just having a hard time figuring out which of those churches would have properties like that.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you, Madam Speaker, for showing up personally to talk about this bill.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, colleagues.
Okay, Seiji Shiratori.
Chair Burdick, committee members, Sage Territory, Oregon Department of Revenue Property Tax Division. We have no position on the bill, and thank you to the speaker for already noting that there's a little bit of potential details that need to be worked out with the Department of Revenue, what the Department of Revenue's role would be in this bill. And I just wanted to give you a little bit of background on what that concern is. In the bill, it says that we would be receiving the initial claims for exemption, as the speaker noted, but it doesn't say what we would then do with them. So it is unusual that we would receive a claim for exemption, except in maybe the example of an enterprise zone for centrally assessed property or state appraised industrial property. We don't typically receive claims for exemptions. Those for residential property typically go to county assessors or local governments. So when they come to us in this bill, it doesn't say we're supposed to adjudicate them. And if it did, we probably don't have the expertise to do that. That would more likely reside with another agency like OHCS. Maybe we'll archive them, maybe we'll forward them to the county assessors, but that's kind of the open question that the bill leaves. So I just wanted to draw that to your attention. And again, thanks to the speaker for already noting that. And I'd be happy to take questions at this point.
Okay, are there questions from the committee? All right, I see no questions, so thank you very much. And with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2008 and open a work session on Senate Bill 806. Mazin?
Yes. Senator Burdick, members of the committee, Senate Bill 806 that you've heard a couple times so far, and a couple amendments that changed the original bill. And now you have in front of you the Dash 7 amendment. And the Dash 7 amendment, what it does, it has all the changes that the Dash 6 had in it. And those basically are the one about including the fortified cider and having the different technical amendments that the OLCC wanted for the fees to be excused at the time of the emergency declaration by the governor, and also for the wine delivery to go from 2 to 5 cases. The difference that -7 introduces new is that it removes the waiting period for the ability of businesses to serve or send drinks for delivery or to go pre-mixed drinks. And the way the bill does that is by amending out the operative time that would have been the case in the Section 4 of Senate Bill 317. That would have that possibility of the to-go pre-mixed drinks delivered was January 1st, 2022. So this bill removes that and allows it to be operative when this bill comes online. So that's the bill for you. The fiscal impact statement is minimal, and so is the revenue impact statement is minimal. And the way and why that would be a minimal revenue impact is that the alcohol sales are already there. Having the delivery pre-mixed drinks does not necessarily change the nature and amounts of alcohol very much that is delivered. So they either are taken away from the store or be delivered by businesses as pre-mixed drinks at the time of the delivery order to the consumer. So that would not in itself make a large revenue impact.
Okay, thank you. And I want to express my appreciation to Senator Beyer and the OLCC for helping us navigate our way through this bill. And I think we got to a good outcome. So, Senator Wagner, do you have a motion?
Yes, Chair Burdick. I move the -7 amendments to Senate Bill 806.
Senator Wagner has moved the -7 amendments to Senate Bill 806. Is there discussion? Okay, clerk, please call the roll.
Senator Finley.
Excused.
Senator Riley.
Votes aye.
Senator Wagner.
Wagner votes aye.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Excused.
Madam Chair, this is Senator Finley. I am here, so I'm sorry.
You are going. You fooled us. So please record Senator Finley's vote. How do you vote, Senator Finley?
I vote aye.
And Vice Chair Boquist.
Boquist, I believe, is still not here, so he's excused.
Madam Chair Burdick.
Burdick votes aye. Senator Wagner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 806 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Wagner has moved Senate Bill 806 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay, please call the roll.
Senator Finley.
Senator Finley votes aye.
Senator Riley.
Votes aye.
Senator Wagner.
Wagner votes aye.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Boquist is excused.
Madam Chair Burdick.
Burdick votes aye. And we will ask Senator Beyer to carry this bill. Thank you very much. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 806 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 139.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. Yes, Senate Bill 139, we do have the -7 and the -10 amendments. The -7 amendment, it is a gut and stuff. It sort of replaces the content of the measure. And what you have in the -7 is this is the information that was presented to the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures on Friday relating to proposed changes to Oregon's reduced rates for pass-through income. So again, you heard this as a joint committee on Friday, but what the bill does with the Dash 7 amendment is it's proposing to change, make adjustments to the marginal rates for the reduced rates for pass-through income. There's then changes related to an employee to employer or an employee to owner ratio. So as a business become more profitable, they'd be required to employ more individuals to qualify. There's also limitation on entities with over $5 million in ordinary business income, also referred to as profits. And then the one other change is the possibility of a business to qualify if they are not meeting the employee to owner ratios. They could still potentially qualify for the program, and they're having their income subject to the reduced rates when it's passed through to individual taxpayers by meeting a reinvestment threshold. So again, this is the same material that was discussed with the committee on Friday. I did upload some of the slides from Friday's discussion into the meeting materials today just for reference purposes and to make them available as well. But they're the same information that was presented to you all on Friday. The Dash 10 amendment is the contents of the Dash 7, which is the PTE changes I just discussed, plus a proposal that the committee has heard about that is language coming from Senate Bill 727, the Dash 2 amendment there. And this relates to a new proposal, and it really builds upon relatively recent federal changes related to the deductibility of state and local taxes. So what's in the Dash 10 amendment is a proposal to create a new pass-through entity tax. The pass-through entity would then pay that tax. That tax would be deductible as a business expense by the pass-through entity, and that leaves less income to be passed through to the individual owners on the personal income tax side of things. To make those personal income taxpayers whole, there is then a credit equal to the amount of the new pass-through entity tax. So you have a new entity tax, and then you have a new personal income tax credit equal to the amount of that new entity tax. The idea that those two would offset each other. But again, that's in the Dash 10 amendment, which has the two proposals together, with the Dash 7 as just the changes proposed to the PTE. One thing I would add is just the applicability date for the changes to the pass-through entity program. That would apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2021. And then the Dash 10, the changes to the entity tax and the subsequent credits are applicable for tax years 2022 and 2023.
Thank you. We'll start out with Ben Gilley from the Oregon Department of Revenue.
Yes, good afternoon, Madam Chair Burdick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ben Gilley with the Oregon Department of Revenue, and I'm here to provide oral testimony on administrative considerations related to the Dash 7 and Dash 10 amendments to Senate Bill 139. So the Dash 7 amendment proposes changes to the existing qualified business income reduced tax rate provisions for pass-through entities. The changes would require updates to existing forms and instructions and some programming for the new rates. Also some education to tax professional community and our staff. There will be some costs, but generally not significant since it is an existing provision. Regarding the Dash 10 amendment, those amendments propose a new elective tax on pass-through entities, as Kyle had explained. The department provided testimony during the public hearing on Senate Bill 727-2, and that. And since that's the same tax, then at that time we had also provided some public testimony on the administrative issues related to bringing up a new tax program. And so we thought we would do the same here for this one. The Dash 10 amendment applies to tax years beginning, again, January 1, 2020 through 2023. And so that's a two-year program. This would be a new program for S corporations and partnerships, and new tax programs generally have significant startup costs related to implementation. And so I wanted to go over some of those costs. The ones that would be considered significant would be programming a system for the new tax program, And then we would also be updating our existing program related to the pass-through entities. We would need to create new forms, and we would need to update existing forms, schedules, and instructions. We would provide some additional direction through administrative rules. And then we would also need to do training to staff in the tax professional community to alert them of this new program and who qualifies and how it works. We would also need to coordinate with our software partners so that it is incorporated in their tax software for filing. And then, of course, with a new program, it creates more additional questions into our call center. And then with the specific provisions of payment of the tax at the entity level and then claiming of the credit at the owner level, then there would be some reconciliation to make sure that those equaled or added up. And then at times when it doesn't, it just creates additional workload on our part to manually correct any differences that may exist. And so those are generally the big administrative costs that would be incurred in bringing up a new program. And we just wanted an opportunity to bring that forward to the committee.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Kind of reading between the lines, it sounds to me like the dash seven would have a minimal fiscal, but the dash 10 could have a more substantial fiscal. Is that a correct assumption?
Madam Chair, that would be a correct assumption.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we will start with our proponents and opponents now. So we'll start with, we'll start with John Calhoun. John?
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and Vice Chair Boquist and members of the committee. My name is John Calhoun, and I'm here today representing Tax Fairness Oregon, a network of volunteers who support a rational and equitable tax code. We urge this committee to support SB 139 and the Dash 10 Amendment. Let us be clear, Tax Fairness Oregon has always opposed a preferential tax treatment for business owners. We testified to that position earlier this year, as we have for several sessions in the past. Almost all the benefits go to higher income individuals, so it worsens an already unfair distribution of wealth and income. It is another version of trickle-down economics. I spent 25 years as a business investor, managing partner, and CFO of multiple businesses, and I would have personally benefited if the current law was in place earlier. Based upon my experience, however, I can say with confidence the lower tax rates for business owners in our existing law provide no economic benefits to the state. They're simply a transfer of wealth to the already privileged or wealthy. These tax preferences increase neither employment nor investment. Saving 1% to 2% of profits does not provide enough incentive to change any behavior other than applying for the lower rates. It is likely that in many partnerships, only the CPAs are even aware of the tax benefit. In spite of these objections, we do support the bipartisan proposals before you today. They eliminate the most egregious aspects of the policy, and the employment and investment criteria are intelligently crafted. The income distribution will be more balanced and progressive. Any meaningful amount of revenue will be returned to the general fund over coming years. And we commend Chair Burdick and Senator Boquist for this proposal. We do want to point out that if this bill becomes law, tax accountants will do their best to work around the limitations in the amendment. Wealthier companies may create multiple corporate entities to ensure that they fit within the limits. We would advise including a provision in this bill to require a study of how it is implemented and if businesses are successful at gaming the system. And if so, future legislatures should address those actions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Okay, I see no questions. So we will move to Scott Bruin.
Okay, well, Madam Chair and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Scott Bruin, and I'm Director of Tax and Fiscal Policy for Oregon Business and Industry. OBI is a member-led business trade association with over 1,600 members that employ approximately 300,000 Oregonians. I am testifying today in opposition to Senate Bill 139 and the Dash 7 and Dash 10 amendments. We are in opposition because the bill and the Dash 7 and Dash 10 amendments would raise taxes on thousands of Oregon partnership businesses at a time when many of those businesses are still gathering themselves from the economic impacts and uncertainty of COVID. These amendments would raise taxes on businesses in every quarter of our state and in just about every commercial activity, although they look like they would have the greatest adverse impacts on professional and medical service firms. Whether these businesses have 20 employees or 200 employees, each, of course, has an interest in keeping those employees working. Senate Bill 139 will make it harder for those businesses to do that. We think it's also important to note that given the incredibly positive revenue position we are in, the state does not need the additional revenues raised by this bill. The monies that would be raised here mean very little in terms of the massive forecasted surpluses and a state budget approaching $30 billion, but it means quite a lot to the businesses that would have to pay it. In fact, it may mean everything to them as they consider whether to expand or even stay in Oregon. Finally, Madam Chair and Committee, I want to point out some potential technical and compliance challenges with the amendments. First, the additional requirement that work be performed by Oregon residents may be unconstitutional in that pass-through entities that employ non-Oregon residents, even if they're performing work in Oregon, could be taxed at higher rates than entities employing only Oregon residents. Second, the proposed 25% cap on distributions appears problematic. Calculating the ratio based on the current year plus the past 2 years restricts the benefit of the rate reduction for entities that complied as of the retroactive effective date and had prior distributions. This makes the measure effectively retroactive to January 1st, 2019. Tax increases based on previous business decisions made in full compliance with the tax laws at the time are likely going to be challenged. For all of these reasons, Madam Chair and Committee, OBI urges opposition to Senate Bill 139 and the Dash 7 and Dash 10 amendments. I thank you and, of course, willing to answer any questions.
Okay, are there questions? Kyle or Chris, probably Kyle, could you address the investment criterion? This is a new provision we put into the program to allow the very small businesses who might just be getting started to allow them an entry into the program even if they didn't meet the employee requirement. And it doesn't exist in the current program, and it's meant to give a little bit more leeway to the smallest businesses. And Kyle, can you address the retroactivity issue?
Sure, yes, Madam Chair. Yeah, to your point on the reinvestment piece, again, there's two requirements there. So the reinvestment piece, if, as you just stated, if a business fails to meet the employee to the owner requirement, then this reinvestment piece would be a secondary way in which they could qualify if they're meeting the reinvestment piece. So it does give another way in which a business would be able to qualify based upon the new proposal. The existing requirement of at least one employee still does exist. So even if a business was reinvesting, they would still be required to have at least that minimum one employee. But it would allow them to qualify without having the employee-to-employer ratio. And in terms of the potential retroactivity, it was looked at as a way of using the current year plus the previous two to average over, in some cases, a three-year period of whether the business is reinvesting, rather than perhaps they qualified for 1 year and the very next year they made a large distribution of those profits, and the next year they didn't, and then the following year after that they made a large distribution. So it could allow in some ways a potential to meet it 1 year, not the next, meet it that following year, then not the next. And this three-year requirement would hopefully encourage that reinvestment as more of, I guess, qualifying a business that is reinvesting and growing rather than one that's just choosing to find a way to meet the qualification requirements for 1 year, maybe not the following.
Thank you. Are there other questions from the committee? Okay, thank you. Our next witness will be Greg Peden.
Hi, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's Greg Peden on behalf of a number of small business clients of mine. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you again. I did testify when the original Senate Bill 727 was before you much earlier in this session. I'm testifying today in support of the Dash 10 amendments, which would incorporate the language from 727 into 139. Just to refresh your memory, this comes to us from some workaround guidelines that the IRS put out last winter, last December, giving explanation for states how to do a workaround on the $10,000 limitation to your state tax deduction at the on your federal taxes. The language that's in the bill here follows those guidelines. A couple things that I wanted to highlight for you today. One is, since we've last talked, about 15 other states, typically states that rely on income taxes like Oregon does, have passed this exact same language in their states and are making those changes accordingly. States such as California, New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, Alabama, Ohio, Kentucky, so a wide range of states around the country. And I wanted to highlight also that as they're making their adjustments, their departments of revenue obviously are making exactly the same determinations on how to implement this law as well. So it is a valuable opportunity that is revenue neutral to the state. It is good for small businesses in our state. And I believe that one of the reasons why it's valuable to us as other states doing this is because capital is portable, and it will help keep investors and small businesses here in Oregon. So with that, happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think it's worth pointing out, too, that this program is likely to benefit some of the people who may not qualify under the changes that we've made to the pass-through program. So it may be another offsetting factor. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe Kyle could, hopefully you can hear me because I'm having computer problems, the officer, but maybe Kyle could give us an example off the top of his head. Mr. Peden pointed out there are the benefits of this. The question I would have is say hypothetically for Kyle, you had a company who made $1 million in profit on their taxes. They're, of course, they were in this program. They're revenue neutral to the state of Oregon, but those taxes they did pay in Oregon would then be deductible at the federal level. And what would be the return or the benefit to that corporation? Say they had $1 million in profit and they were able to now once again deduct those taxes, what would their benefit be at the federal level? Do you have an idea, Kyle?
Yeah, Senator Boquist, I hesitate to give examples on the fly because I'm afraid of missing a detail, but the key point here is, again, right now, the state and local taxes, the SALT cap, would be limiting those deductions to $10,000. And the ability to then deduct those at the business level and then have them pass through could make a substantial difference based upon an individual's marginal tax rate. And we know those are quite a bit higher at the federal level than they are here at Oregon. So you could be talking 30% deductibility, just using kind of a round number. But again, it could even go a bit higher depending on the individual taxpayer and what their tax situation would be. But again, these benefits would be on their federal taxation, and then the Oregon credit would intend to offset that Oregon tax at the entity level.
Do you have a follow-up, Senator Boquist?
No, ma'am. I'm just trying to, it would be helpful maybe at the next meeting to have a couple of examples for the committee members and for other people so that they actually see the benefit to them, because it's certainly, when you can deduct 30% or more of that off of your federal tax return, that's a significant tax cut to some of these small businesses.
Yes, and when I first saw this bill, I thought, wouldn't it be nice if we could do this for all Oregon taxpayers? So thank you for that. Are there other questions from the committee? I see no other questions. So we will move to Sean Cleave.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Taxpayers, Taxpayers Association of Oregon. I appreciate you calling on me. I know that my registration was late in the day. Madam Chair, registering our objections to the both the Dash 7 and Dash 10 amendments, first and foremost in the Dash 7, obviously there is a effort in Oregon, I think, and rightfully so, a conversation regarding taxing suits and scrubs, one that the assembly hasn't quite been able to address in an equitable manner. I think, especially in the Senate, members of the committee know that sometimes broad brushstrokes can have unintended consequences. Secondly, regarding the new language in the Dash 10s, I think that there's a conflict of philosophies between both the Dash 7 and Dash 10s. However, that being said, even if there isn't, there is a definite measure of sophistication for those businesses, whether they be large or small, as they approach reconciling their tax their taxation levels if the bill is to move forward with either the Dash 7 or Dash 10 amendments. Finally, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'd like to remind you all that the legislature has $5 billion extra in general fund, or in operating funds from Congress. We are setting records in the amount of revenue that has been collected through income tax statements. We believe, although we are kind of cross-checking this, that smaller businesses will end up, if this bill is to move forward, having a higher revenue or a higher tax rate than some of the larger entities in Oregon. And then finally, Madam Chair, 13 counties in Oregon are still at high risk. Many, many small businesses across the state are suffering, and they will, as a result, for many years, if they've been able to stay in business over those past year. And Madam Chair, I would just ask that you consider those points in your perspectives on taking up these amendments. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony.
Thank you, Sean. In the amendment, we actually reduce the tax rate for some of the smallest businesses, and they have a far lower threshold for, they have a lower rate to start out with and a far lower threshold for number of employees required. So how do you conclude that they could end up paying a higher rate than the larger businesses, which pay a higher rate and have a higher employee requirement?
Madam Chair, I appreciate the question, and I had anticipated it. I saw a lot of the language that you and I had worked on when we provided some estate tax relief for family-owned farming entities in Oregon at least over 10 years ago. I think that the point that I'd like to make in regard to picking winners and losers is that the Assembly has the unfortunate task of defining the line between winners and losers, small businesses or large businesses. And when it comes down to it, we live in a society of more gray and nuanced policy than is provided to the Assembly in providing those bright lines on either side.
Yeah, I still don't see how you conclude that a small business that pays a 7% rate would pay higher rate than a large business which pays 9% or even 9.9 if they're after 5 million.
And Madam Chair, again, referring back to my testimony, we're running some traps on that assessment. I'm waiting to verify those things, but we have reason to believe that there may be some scenarios which LRO would be obviously providing based on the request from Senator Boquist. And we're happy to help truth test those scenarios as well.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Okay, thank you. Now we'll move to Daniel Hauser.
Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Boquist, and members of the committee. My name is Daniel Hauser, Tax Policy Analyst for the Oregon Center for Public Policy, and I respectfully submit this testimony in support of Senate Bill 139 with the Dash 7 or Dash 10 amendments, although I'll mostly speak to the Dash 10s. The pass-through reduced tax rates currently in law are fundamentally flawed and inequitable, and they should be eliminated. And in fact, I'm glad that Mr. Cleave brought up the winners and losers, right, that the legislature often has to determine between the two with many of the policies that are brought forward. And our current policy is a great example of that because it has selected winners, right, profitable businesses, and the more profits, the bigger the winner, right, the bigger the tax break you get, all the way up to $5 million and beyond. And I think the losers are the businesses that lose money in a tax year, right? If you don't have profits, the reduced tax rates provide zero benefit to a business. And so businesses that are struggling to keep the doors open, who are receiving no profits after reinvesting back in their business, don't benefit at all from our current policy. And neither do the employees of those businesses receive any benefit. And so I think when we consider the winners and losers with this reform, as Senator, Senator Burdick pointed out, what we see is that the shift in the winners and losers is towards smaller businesses, is towards businesses that are employing significant people in their communities and are reinvesting in their business. And I think that the losers more so become those businesses that have more than $5 million in annual profits. And I think that's the right kind of reform of this policy to improve who is really benefiting from public policy in Oregon. It should be focused more heavily on the Oregonians that need the help the most, the businesses that are truly struggling and are really reinvesting in their community. And so I think these amendments, as I mentioned, are an improvement, are a significant boost to the current policy. And I will say that although our preference would be to completely eliminate these reduced tax rates and treat employees and employers equally, these policies are an improvement in the right direction. We are concerned, though, about the fact that the Dash 7 amendments make an already very complicated policy even more complicated. Consider that, you know, whenever we have this added complexity, that there's opportunities for gaming the system for savvy taxpayers who can restructure their business and use other tax avoidance techniques to lower their tax bill. So to ensure this legislation doesn't create new problems and to assess the effectiveness of the reform, we think the policy should be amended to require LRO to study the policy and report back during the 23 legislative session to the House and Senate Finance Committees. The evaluation should assess what the racial and ethnic distribution is of the tax benefits. It's something we don't know a lot about right now, and I think would be really helpful for evaluating the policy on an ongoing basis, as well as examining how taxpayers are adjusting their incorporation statuses to take advantage of the reforms and to reevaluate the revenue impact. I know that poor Kyle, as has been mentioned, has been, you know, lost in the caves of DOR, and I suspect that this is a robust, you know, revenue estimate given the data that he has had available to him. But I think having this policy in effect for a few years will certainly give us much better data to work from in understanding what the impacts and implications are. So to close, reduced tax rates on pass-through income is an inherently inequitable policy that should be eliminated. However, scaling back this subsidy as the Dash 7 and Dash 10s do is a move in the right direction. So we'd urge you to amend Senate Bill 139 to include a study and then pass this legislation. And I'm happy to answer any questions the committee has.
Okay, thank you. And we actually don't need legislation to have a study because LRO does those as a matter of routine, but it is a very good suggestion. Are there questions from the committee? Okay, I see no questions. So now we will move to Bruce Anderson.
Madam Chair, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, a little louder if you could.
Okay, sorry about that, Madam Chair. This is a little bit of a new thing for yours truly, so I appreciate the accommodation here. Just for the record, Bruce Anderson representing the Oregon Family Farm Association, and I really appreciate the opportunity to appear before y'all today. Oregon Family Farm Association is dedicated to protecting the heritage of Oregon's family farms, helping farmers and educating the public about the health of family farming in Oregon. And OFFA opposes Senate Bill 139 and the proposed amendments, and we urge you to not move the legislation forward. I just want to convey our concerns on this issue from an Oregon ag perspective. we share OBI's concerns regarding this measure, and just with the impact, especially in Oregon Ag, over this past year due to COVID-19. Senate Bill 139, along with the proposed amendments, constitute a disruption to our state's economic recovery. We feel the proposals are going to hit Oregon's family farms hard, and raising personal income tax rates on family-owned small businesses like family farms, many of which are structured as pass-through or partnership entities. The proposed changes in the Dash 7 and Dash 10 amendments specifically have some harmful tax increases on businesses in light of the recent, which we feel are unnecessary. And just to echo what Mr. Bruin noted on the state revenue forecast and how robust that is right now. These amendments are going to hit Oregon farm operations, which may have a higher income one year, but given the nature of ag on a year-to-year basis, you're not always going to see that. And so I don't feel that that's really reflected in the proposed policy here. It's also worth noting that the proposed change will trip up the smallest of small companies who are just now starting to hire people. The other concern that we would share with you all is on the proposed amendments and the requirements on a business's operations. Under the proposals, the state of Oregon would be directing how a private business runs by establishing a minimum number of employees, how many hours its employees would work, and how income from the business is distributed amongst the owners, which that's a huge concern of ours. So Oregon Family Farm Association, we just ask you to reject the bill and the proposed amendments and really appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Okay, I see no questions. We will now move on to Anthony Smith.
Chair Burdick and Vice Chair Boquist and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Anthony Smith. I'm the Oregon State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business, representing thousands of small businesses across the state, many being the smallest of small businesses, with about 90% of our members in Oregon having fewer than 25 employees and 70% having fewer than 10 employees. Madam Chair, NFIB is opposed to Senate Bill 139 along with the Dash 7s and the Dash 10 amendments because these proposals significantly restrict eligibility for Oregon's pass-through entity tax rate policy while at the same time unnecessarily raising revenue. Unlike other approaches which could reform the policy to achieve certain revenue-neutral policy goals, Senate Bill 139 simply raises revenue without a specific policy objective to justify the tax increases and provides no tax benefit for small businesses with the most modest levels of income. It just makes it harder for them to qualify for the program. Taking you back in time just a little bit, the small business pass-through entity tax rates were part of the grand bargain in the 2013 special session. And that package of bills that passed during the special session included House Bill 3601, which among other provisions that raised revenue overall, created this policy that we're talking about today with the express purpose of providing a more favorable rate structure for these businesses. As another reminder, Oregon has already disconnected from federal tax policy related to pass-through entities. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 used a tax parity lens to make sure that both C corporations and pass-through entities benefited as equally as possible from the tax cuts. C Corp saw their corporate tax rates reduced from 35% to 21% at the federal level, and pass-through businesses were able to apply a new 20% deduction on their qualifying business income. That's the Section 199A deduction to reduce their federal tax liability. Now, you'll remember that during the 2018 regular session, the legislature passed Senate Bill 1528, which required an add back of that federal deduction as Oregon taxable income, primarily because the state already had its own tax policy for pass-through entities, this very policy we're discussing now.
The governor then called a special session to pass House Bill 4301, which expanded the PTE rates to sole proprietorships and single owner LLCs, which were a group of businesses that were left out of the original legislation. The net result of this change was that while Oregon's PTE policy now benefits around 25,000 businesses, hundreds of thousands of businesses missed out on the tax savings they would have received on their Oregon income taxes had the state remained connected to the federal 20% pass-through deduction. Now, I want to acknowledge that while the Dash 7s and the Dash 10s broaden the lowest PTE rate, the 7% rate, to income up to $500,000 and provides a slight decrease from 7.6 to 7.5% for income between $500,000 and $1 million, businesses with more than $5 million in income would be prohibited from opting into the program, and that would be retroactive starting January 1, 2021, if not more than that, as you heard my colleague Scott Bruin talk about in terms of retroactivity, potentially several years past. Additionally, a new requirement that would be applied to S corporations and partnerships, the sole proprietors, as noted by staff, would be exempt from these new requirements, but we would still appreciate some clarity on how single owner LLCs would be treated under the policy, but the business subject businesses subject to this requirement would need to meet or exceed the new Oregon employee to Oregon owner ratio adjusted based on income, and to or reinvest in at least 75% of the business profits back into the business. That could be a difficult threshold. Additionally, from a tax expenditures perspective, in terms of dollars, this policy over the years has performed exactly as it was intended. In the 5 years of data that LRO has presented, the revenue impact to the state has come in at or under projections each year, and the number of taxpayers utilizing the rate structure has been relatively stable year over year. And the sideboards that were part of the original legislation that passed in the 2013 special session have not been triggered, and I don't think they're going to be triggered. Which leads me to my final point, and that's about the May revenue forecast. It was incredibly strong, projecting a $2.8 billion positive ending balance. And this is in addition to the $2.6 billion in direct financial aid from the Biden administration's American Rescue Plan Act. And that's not even counting the additional federal ARPA dollars going to local jurisdictions. So given this, there's no budgetary justification for a tax increase of any sort, including tax increases on pass-through businesses, especially Oregon's smallest family-owned businesses, that would see no benefit from these proposed changes to the Oregon PTE rate structure. So with that said, Madam Chair, respectfully, NFIB asks the committee to oppose these amendments as well as the base bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? I see no questions. So we will call Emily Sewells.
Sorry, I'm not sure if you can hear me. Madam Chair, Vice Chair Boquist, and members of the committee, for the record, Emily Sewells here representing the Oregon Small Business Association in opposition to Senate Bill 139 and the Dash 7 and Dash 10 amendments. I've had the honor, but also the challenge, of speaking with several small business owners throughout the pandemic. I say challenge because it's been heartbreaking to hear the struggles faced by so many small business owners as they've navigated the pandemic, had supply chain disruptions, adjusted to a higher minimum wage. They've had higher costs due to inflation, and they've been hit with higher costs with the increasing price of gas. Many of these businesses have shared that their pre-pandemic customer flow has yet to return. The Oregon Small Business Association opposes Senate Bill 139 and the Dash 7 and Dash 10 amendment, which taxes Oregon businesses as they recover from a global pandemic. With lockdowns and fewer customers over the last year, there simply isn't a surplus of money to tax. Some of these businesses make no profit at all. In a time of record revenue, this isn't the time to add taxes on the backs of business as they're struggling to recover. For those reasons, Madam Chair, the Oregon Small Business Association urges a no on Senate Bill 139 and the Dash 7 and Dash 10 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think since Senator Boquist and I had a keen eye on small business and wanting to protect small business, because that's what this program was originally structured to help. And so I just want to remind people that if a business is not profitable, they don't pay any taxes on, under this program or existing tax system. The favorable rates for small businesses, especially the smallest businesses, apply only to profits. And so if a small business is struggling and doesn't have very much profit, they will qualify for the 7% rate instead of instead of the regular rate that Oregon taxpayers pay for on their W-2 wages, which would be much higher. So I just want to make that clear for the record that our intent with these changes were to keep the program in place for people who are the smallest businesses trying to grow and the businesses that employ a lot of Oregonians. So I just wanted to make that clear for the record. That concludes our witness list. Senator Boquist, did you have any other comments?
Yep, am I on?
You're on.
Yeah, I would like to ask that to get staff to run up a couple of scenarios. Just for everybody, one of the challenges with providing data is that I have yet to pass a bill that allows the release of all of the data that many people claim we get to the committee members, because we don't get it. So therefore, Kyle has to go over and spend, you know, hours and hours, and in this particular case, almost weeks on end, going through tax returns and tax data, upwards of, you know, thousands of entities, of which he's under the pain of death and penalty that he can't tell us who they are. But I think it would be beneficial for members of the public and for the various organizations if we put together two or three or three or four scenarios, example scenarios, not on the fly, as Kyle's squirming around someplace on the machine right now, showing if you had the A10 as example, this is your overall impact if you were an entity of X amount of dollars, say you had 500,000 in profit or a million in profit. And if you were an entity that was over 5 million and you didn't qualify, but you qualified for the SALT, this is sort of the scenario that is out there. Having owned multiple businesses and written multiple checks myself to lots of employees, and for those in the record or out there, one of the problems we had is you don't get to name company X or company Y, but we actually used several companies that I owned in the past, and we used, you know, kind of went through examples to figure out what the impact was. And, you know, unfortunately for tax fairness Oregon, in almost all cases, I would have got a tax cut under the A10, not a tax increase, between the offsetting federal and the rest of the material that's out there. So I think it would behoove us to get LRO and, you know, take up OBI and some of the others and Sean at their offer to put together some scenarios and look at, so people can understand overall what the impact might be. That we go across, because there is a reason the numbers are the way they are right now. But I actually do think, in my case, again, it would have been tax cuts to my small business, not tax increases. And of course, we were reinvesting back into the countries. Last thing I'd point out too is those who were around in 2013 and know this is the whole goal back there coming out of the 08-09 recession, which we were still basically behind the power curve in 2013 when we did this stuff, was to try and get businesses to create jobs and get business to reinvest money. And so that's sort of the direction we're going. Nobody touched the Governor Brown proposal of sole proprietorships. You all know that came out later as we went down low. But with that, Madam Chair, I will just shut up at the moment.
Thank you for that, Senator Boquist. And thank you all for coming with your thoughts and testimony. And so that I see no more witnesses. Doug, is that correct? We have no more witnesses?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 139. And Chris, how are we looking for paperwork on Senate Bill 464?
Madam Chair, we do not have the fiscal impact statement So I don't know if you want to hold it over to Wednesday or if you want to talk about the Dash 5 amendment. And I think Jamie can talk a little bit to where she is on the revenue impact statement. I don't know if you want to do part of it now or just wait all.
We're kind of running out of time here in this session. So let's do as much as we can today. So let's open a work session on Senate Bill 464 because we have not talked about the Dash 5 amendment yet.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Jamie McGovern for Legislative Revenue Office. The Dash 5, starting with the Senate Bill 464, this is a property tax relief measure that's specific to the 2020 wildfires. The Dash 5 replaces the bill. This specifically directs cancellation of 5/6 of the property taxes that are imposed for the counties that impose such an ordinance. So a county can choose, if this measure were adopted, to adopt a local ordinance, and then 1/6 of the property taxes would be collected, and then the rest would be canceled for properties that were affected or properties that had service disruptions during the 2020 wildfires. And we have some information back from the counties. As you probably know, for the type of property tax bills that are permissive or opt-in, we often state that there's no direct revenue impact, and that's true because any of the counties could choose to or choose not to adopt such a local ordinance. And in this case, it would be similar to the 464 originally, where the when they adopt a local ordinance, they would draw a map describing and showing the affected properties. And in this case, starting with the count, one of the counties that has some detailed information and a map already drawn, what they noticed was that the amount of tax revenue loss under the bill with the Dash 5 is somewhere between 2 to 2.5 times the amount of loss that you would currently see under current law, which still allows for a property tax cancellation in the case of a fire, but, you know, with an application process and such. So the extrapolating from that one county for to other affected counties, it's a little less than 5 million if all the counties that were affected and the suspected properties were to be included. That might be an upper bound, but that it's a little bit unknown because it's an opt-in measure and we don't have the fiscal. So that's a general summary, and I'm here to answer questions, obviously. And we may also have other people if you have questions more about the policy.
Okay, I did see Ellen Miller in the lobby. I assume she's still there. If we have questions of her, so Jamie, I was pulled aside for a second here. The $5 million potential impact would be lost to the county, right? It would not be there. There's not a general fund impact. Is that correct?
Chair Burdick, that's correct. I'll just state to the a caveat that so these are property tax revenues. Those are local dollars, as you stated. That's an extrapolation to all the counties. So that's statewide, and it's likely disparate. So some counties might see more or less of that 5 million approximately, depending on how severe the damage was in their areas. Some counties might not choose to adopt this at all. And then that would be local as well.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions of Jamie? Thank you, that was very helpful, Jamie. But we still don't have the fiscal impact, so we will have to hold Senate Bill 464 over to the next meeting. So Chris, do we have anything else? Did I overlook anything here? We have moved Senate Bill 2963 to Wednesday's meeting. And I think that covers us. Is that right, Chris?
I think so, Madam Chair. You've gone through the agenda. The only other thing would be if Senator Boquist wants to vote on Senate Bill 806.
Oh, okay. Senator Boquist, would you like to vote on Senate Bill 806? So far, it's 4-0.
It's 5-0, so I request permission to suspend the rules. Unanimous consent of the committee to suspend the rules to vote on the bill and a vote yes.
Okay, do I see any objections? I see no objections. The rules are suspended. How do you vote?
Yes.
Okay, please record Senator Boquist as a yes vote on Senate Bill 806. Okay, with that, we have finished our agenda and we are adjourned.